Well, good morning, everyone. Here at Sherbrooke Street, where the light is streaming in, and out there at Wall Street, and everybody out in the Zoom realm. If you're comfortable turning on your camera, that's nice to see who's out there. Looks like people from quite a geographical span, so that's pretty good. I hope it's not too smoky wherever you are. My voice is feeling a little rough still after these days of smoke. And the folks out in the wildfire zones in many places, not just here in BC, but different parts of the world, have been often in my heart and mind, as probably has been the case for many of you these weeks. This is going to be a little more personal talk than usual. I'm going to tell you a couple stories, but first, I'll do a bit of lead into the stories. What I want to talk about today is leaving home and returning home, which all of us surely have done in some form or another. When we open the Zendo every week, a volunteer makes an offering of sage or flower petals and then chants a verse, which ends, "May we be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home." And of course, the forgetfulness here is that we forget that we are already home, that we're already connected, we're already part of this vast universe. We're not alone. To realize our true home, sometimes we have to leave our conditional home, the home we grew up in or have become attached to, a place, a family, neighbors, a culture, a nation, a heritage, an identity, a religion. Sometimes we embark on a journey, wandering, a pilgrimage. And eventually, often, there's a return, a coming home, or a seeing our old home in a new way. As the poet T.S. Eliot wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Or we could say, to know our true home, our true self, for the first time. As you probably know, in the Buddhist tradition, a monk or a nun is referred to as a home leaver, referring to those who left behind their home, their family, and their possessions, as the Buddha himself did, to take up the path, the Buddhist path. And even today, in our tradition, priest ordination is called Shukke Tokudo, leaving home, attaining the way, and lay ordination, which is Jukai, we usually call it Jukai, receiving the precepts, lay ordination is called Zaike Tokudo, staying home, attaining the way. In our tradition, as it's evolving here in the West, there's not such a sharp distinction between the home leavers and the home stayers, between priest and lay practice. Few ordained priests in our tradition are lifelong celibate monastics. Often they an intimate relationship, whether marriage or otherwise, and sometimes have families and have jobs and live in the world to a larger, greater or lesser extent. And monasteries are permeable. Lay people go and do a full practice period along with those who are ordained, practicing side by side. So we enter monastic practice even when we come to the Zendo for 2 hours, or where we go to a sesshin for a week. So for all of us, leaving home and staying home are more cyclic and also more metaphorical. Why do we leave home? There are as many answers as there are home leavers. One, I think, is the atavistic urge to migrate with the seasons, with the food supply, as our ancient ancestors did. Why else would swarms of urban and suburban North Americans go to the trouble of packing up their cars with tents, food, and camping gear, and more often these days, monstrous RVs, and traveling to a nearby or faraway campground where they park cheek by jowl with other campers, creating a kind of pseudo-tribe, drinking beer and roasting various kinds of meat or pseudo-meat, getting away from the constraints of their ordinary, over-civilized lives. Michael and I went on a camping trip just recently, and we were so relieved to get home to our house, which was much quieter than the campgrounds. But we did enjoy sleeping in the tent. There's something very old, a very ancient feeling about sleeping in the tent. But sometimes home leaving is much more than a vacation. Sometimes it comes from an acute awareness that home is not a wholesome environment. It could be the family home or the home identity of a town, city, nation, or culture that binds and constricts rather than comforts and nourishes. That kind of home leaving can take the form of an escape, I gotta get out of this place, or a search for another way of living, a wider way of seeing. Or often it's some kind of combination of escape and search. Our continent is full of immigrants and offspring of immigrants who left home perhaps to seek fortune and security in the so-called New World, perhaps to escape starvation or poverty or persecution in the old. Some home leaving is not chosen. It is exile or escape from the possibility of imprisonment, torture, even death. Or it's fleeing the ravages of war, or more recently, climate extremes. We now have the phrase climate refugees. How do refugees turn their home leaving into a spiritual journey? Some do. Remember Salman Rushdie, the writer who went into hiding after the Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa against him for his novel, The Satanic Verses. In his book, Imaginary Homelands, he says, "It may be argued that the past is a country from which we have all emigrated, that its loss is part of our common humanity." Yeah, so we all, in some way, look back at the past as a home that we've left. In his own exile from home, Rushdie connected to the human condition. Our teacher, Norman Fisher, wrote an unusual and fascinating book called Sailing Home. Here it is. Sailing Home using the wisdom of Homer's Odyssey to navigate life's perils and pitfalls. That sounds like a publisher's subtitle to me. They were hoping to get it into the self-help section. Doesn't even mention Zen, but Norman weaves Buddhist and Zen practice and teachings throughout this discussion of the epic home leaving and journey of Odysseus in the Odyssey, journeying and return. Norman writes, "Leaving home means setting aside all we know, all that is secure, authoritative, comfortable, and binding, and shoving off for parts unknown with no roadmap and no guarantee of finding your way. Though it can look like, and even in some cases can be, a form of running away, an act of cowardice, real home leaving is courageous, requiring heart and force. To go forward, you must leave everything behind, and even though the past may seem to be persistent, lodged as it is in our very bones, it is one thing to be bound up by the past, doomed to repeat it, or to be held back by it endlessly, and another to use it as a springboard for a journey that goes beyond. To where, one can never know." And then, of return, he says, "Return is also a fact of nature. The universe expands and contracts. The tides go out and come in. Celestial bodies go around and around. The seasons begin, endure, draw to a close, come around again. The spiritual journey, the human journey, is as natural as this. We begin at home, we leave home, we return home. Even when it looks like we're going far afield, we're always on our way back. We have what we need, and we are where we are going. The spiritual journey is a journey of return." Maybe some of us North Americans who are third or fourth or fifth generation immigrants have a need to seek out older cultures from a longing for reconnection with a lost past we have not even known we were missing. Rebecca Solnit, the writer I admire, wrote a book called, an early book, called A Book of Migrations, about her travels in Ireland. It's not a travelogue, but an exploration of identity through travel. She grew up in a secular Californian environment. Although her mother's parents were both Irish immigrants and her father's were Russian Jewish immigrants, she had no sense of personal history or identity with either of those ethnicities. My heritage is Irish, English, and Dutch, but I grew up with no sense of meaning of those ethnicities whatsoever. I was just a generic American. And what was that? Solnit writes, "New and unknown places call forth strange, often forgotten correspondences and desires in the mind, so that the motion of travel takes place as much in the psyche as anywhere else. Travel offers the opportunity to find out who else one is in that collapse of identity into geography that I want to trace." And she does. So I imagine maybe some of you, have traveled in that way she calls this a psychic experiment. Who am I here? Sometimes we find aspects of ourselves in places and cultures that seem entirely foreign to our geographical and ethnic background, and yet we experience a deep resonance. We open into other ways of being human, other ways of raising families, using language, singing and dancing. And then when we return, we see our own places of origin with fresh eyes, with new perspectives. I would say my own journey to live in Japan was certainly motivated by a kind of quest to discover other ways of being human. I didn't want to go through life monolingual and monocultural. I wasn't looking for a religion or a spiritual practice. I'd been disillusioned by my Aikido and Tai Chi teachers whose behavior did not always align with their disciplines. But through some fortunate encounters, I did begin Zen practice in Japan, and we'll be always grateful. That departure for Japan with a backpack and a large duffel bag, however, was preceded by previous significant departures, one from my family home and hometown at the age of 17, and my country at the age of 19, with my long-ago partner, our earthly possessions packed into a 1951 Willys Jeep station wagon. And then another leave-taking from the home he and I made on a 100-acre farm on the Bay of Fundy, which brought me to Vancouver when I was something like 26. How many leave-takings have you had in your life? What did each one mean? Where did it take you? And have there been returns? An aspect of home leaving for some of us is leaving the religious tradition within which we were raised. I was raised in the Calvary Baptist Church, the first Calvary Baptist Church in a little town in New Jersey. And I attended regularly with my family every Sunday. My mom desperately trying to get us all out the door to church on time. It wasn't a fundamentalist Baptist church. I later characterized it as aspiring to be as middle class as the Presbyterians, but a little more righteous. Our minister at that time talked more about dignity and human rights than hellfire and brimstone. But the congregation on the whole was more conservative, which led to my leaving the church on the cusp of adolescence for reasons I'll speak of in a moment. But I'd like to share two personal stories this morning, after that long introduction, of going back to church after decades away. The first story is from 2018, and I'm going to read you what I wrote not long afterwards. Here's what I wrote. I rarely go to church. On Sunday mornings, I go to the Zendo and meditate. But I went to church twice in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in the 10 days leading up to the U.S. midterm elections in 2018. I'd arrived in from Vancouver late on October 26, the night before my mother's 95th birthday. The next morning, it was still too early to go to my mother's room in the nursing care wing of the seniors complex where my parents live. I went to the nearby supermarket to buy a New York Times, forgetting that the big weekend paper comes on Sunday, not Saturday, as in Canada. I bought the paper anyway, and there on the front page were two angry men. The lead story was about Cesar Sayoc, who had just been arrested for sending pipe bombs to 12 prominent individuals who had voiced strong opposition to Donald Trump. Sayoc himself was a passionately angry Trump supporter, a deeply disturbed individual. The photo of Sayoc showed a muscular man in a sleeveless t-shirt at a political rally holding up a poster saying "Boycott CNN." Below was a small photo of the van Sayoc had been living in, covered in posters spewing hate-filled messages. He hated a lot of people, seemingly the same people Donald Trump hated. The article to the left highlighted the president's pushback against press coverage of the pipe bomber. It had no photo because everyone had already seen the president's angry face enough and could easily summon that image to mind. Sometime later that day, I learned about the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh that morning. Strangely, I seem to have lost the memory of how I found out and where I was. I think I heard it on the car radio. I do know I did not speak to my family about it. I carried it like a stone in my belly as we celebrated my mother's birthday. The next morning, I went again to buy the Sunday New York Times. On the front page was a photo of a woman embracing her two daughters, holding a Jewish prayer book, as they stood outdoors near the Tree of Life Synagogue. To the right was a small photo of the shooter, who looked eerily similar to the pipe bomber in a generic way. Clean-shaven, buzz-cut, heavy-set. Apparently, he was virulently anti-Semitic. Also on the front page below was a large photo of a starving 7-year-old girl in Yemen, where an ongoing minority insurgency battled government troops armed by the U.S. and Canada while children starved. All this converged, and tears streamed down my cheeks as I walked into the parking lot and stood holding the New York Times to my heart. That evening, I went to church to practice with the local Zen group, which meets in the basement of the Unitarian Church. It seemed kind of miraculous for me to be sitting Zazen in the heart of one of America's Bible Belts. I'd been asked to give a guest Dharma talk, so I chose to talk about suffering and resilience in troubled times, which was the theme of our fall practice period here at Mountain Rain. It seemed apropos. A week later, Sunday, the front page of the New York Times featured a photo of Reverend S.C. Manning embracing Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of the Tree of Life Synagogue. Reverend Manning was the pastor of the Emmanuel Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where on June 17, 2015, 9 parishioners were gunned down by a young white man who hated black people. Reverend Manning had traveled to Pittsburgh to express support and solidarity. That Sunday was the day of my departure. I had a late flight. I'd already decided to attend church with my brother's family. It would be my way of bearing witness, sitting in vigil. I also wanted to hear my niece sing. She'd graduated from the Philadelphia University of the Arts the previous June with a degree in voice performance and was now working retail at Victoria's Secret at Park City Mall, struggling with the anxiety that so afflicts the young these days, and not going for auditions, to her parents' consternation. It's a thriving Methodist church with 3 consecutive Sunday morning services. As we waited in the lobby for the previous service to end, I read on a notice board that this was the first church in Lancaster to become a reconciliation church, explicitly welcoming LGBTQ people to worship. I heard music and looked up at the large screen monitor showing the service in progress. My niece and a woman playing piano were singing a lovely contemporary gospel song with a tinge of country, accompanied by a young man on guitar. In the foreground, the woman minister, wearing a white robe, was performing a communion service. She held a large round loaf of bread and tore pieces off, handed them alternately to 2 women on either side, who dipped them in wine and handed them to the people who came forward in a line. In my childhood, it was Welch's grape juice, And the bread was white Wonder Bread cut into cubes, passed from pew to pew on trays by male ushers. Suddenly tears just spontaneously started pouring from my eyes down my cheeks. Completely inadvertently, without any mental narrative, just a kind of upwelling of what? Of grief for my country, of some lost connection, of my childhood, where there was no place for women in that church. It wasn't even articulated in my mind, just tears flowing. The service ended. I pulled myself together and I went into the church sanctuary and sat alone because my brother and sister-in-law were serving as ushers and they would sit in the rear once the next service started. I wondered, would I go up to receive communion? And what would that mean if I did? I, who believe that Jesus Christ was a man, a great spiritual teacher, no more or less the Son of God than any of us. I, who left the church at 13, when our congregation voted not to invite the members of Second Calvary Baptist Church, the African American or black church located two blocks of our small town where all the black people lived. Our congregation voted not to invite them when they were without a minister for a time. I also found, by the time I reached that age, that I could not believe in a Father God who would condemn some to heaven and some to eternal damnation. I simply didn't relate to a personified God at all. And Jesus was a model for living a life of kindness and witness, not my personal savior. And though that wasn't part of my decision to leave, the only place for women in that church was in the kitchen, teaching Sunday school, or organizing the rummage sale. And I was not interested in the kind of constricted possessiveness they demonstrated in those roles. So why would I want to receive communion from this woman minister far from my home and country of choice? Once the music started and I listened to my brave niece's lovely voice, the tears rolled down again, and I breathed as deeply as I could. What was it about the breaking of bread and the ritual serving of wine in spiritual community that struck some deep ancient chord in me, that after a week of mourning again tapped the well of grief I carry about my country of origin? The pastor didn't even say, "This is my body, which is given to you. Do this in remembrance of me," which is what they used to say, repeating Christ's words. Or if she did, I missed it. I stood and walked up to take my place in the line, waited my turn, and received the bread with both hands, Japanese style, with the slightest bow, and ate it. I wasn't having some sort of charismatic conversion or reconversion experience, but rather a kind of reconciliation. I was joining with thousands across the country who were grieving the violence and hatred so virulently expressed in the past week in the United States of America. And I was recommitting body, heart, and mind to another way of living, to love and responsibility towards not just me and mine, but the marvelous diversity of human and more than human life on this earth. A week or so later, I saw in the New York Times a little sidebar and learned that that 7-year-old Yemeni girl whose image so tore at my heart died only a few days later after the photo appeared. And that her name was Amal, Arabic for hope. So when I wrote this piece, which I haven't done anything with other than read it to you now, these years later, I said this piece is dedicated to her and to all victims of war, oppression, and hatred. So I have a second story. This one's a little lighter, about going back to church. And this one dates just from 2 months ago. Over the past 7 years or so, I have been visiting my parents every spring and fall, ever since they were no longer able to make the trip out here to visit. I had been last in October 2019, and I was planning to go in 2020 when the pandemic intervened. I was going to go in May, and it was May 5th that my mom died in the first COVID lockdown in her nursing home at the age of 96. And I joined the many thousands of family members around the world who are unable to be there with their loved ones in their last days and hours. A year later, I managed to travel amid COVID restrictions and complications in time for the anniversary of her death, and I stayed for a month as my father's health declined. And he would die a few months later in early September at the age of 95. So this year, I felt this strange pull to go back at that time of year, into that landscape of my childhood, the hardwood forest, the wildflowers, and birds. As I come closer to my own mortality, I find myself reviewing and integrating the different times and places and experiences of my life. So I rented a car from where my brother still lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I drove to New Jersey. I visited a cousin I'd reconnected with. I stayed at an Airbnb, and then on Sunday morning, I drove to my old hometown. I decided to go to the cemetery, to the family plot, where my parents and my younger sister's ashes are interred. And on the way, I passed our old church, looking as it had for years, classic white clapboard with a steeple, high clear glass windows. The front door was open, but the sign said the service was not until 11, and it was just after 10. So I went to the cemetery, not something that I do very often. I hadn't even stopped to buy flowers, but I found a Japanese maple and put some red leaves on each grave. And then, to my surprise, I went to church. It was completely unplanned, but the timing was right, and it was based on a strong feeling that I was honoring and remembering my mom by doing so. My mom had experienced the death of her mother when she was 12 and her father 3 years later in the midst of the Great Depression in the American 1930s. The five children were sent to live with various relatives, my mom landing with a not very welcoming older aunt and uncle. The church became her lifeline and her family. The last time I'd been there was in 1990, the year my younger sister died, when we held a memorial service for her, and the church was absolutely packed with people who had come out to support my parents, even though by then they'd been living in Pennsylvania for some years. So upon my arrival, two older women greeted me, and when I said who I was, they both remembered my parents. I went in and sat down in the middle by myself, but soon another older woman rushed up to me saying, "Kate, how are you?" It was Sophia Peterson. She hadn't seen me in 30 years. A dear old friend of my mom's, recognized me immediately and invited me to come sit with her and her grandson, his wife, and their little boy. She proceeded to chat and make comments to me throughout the service. First announcing, "Kate, you be proud of us now. We're much more liberal." I was flabbergasted that she would remember me well enough to want to let me know that. The minister did not stand up on the pulpit, but right down in front of the pews with a lectern with his little laptop propped up on it for the Zoom people. And he didn't wear a black robe, and he had a young woman seminarian read the Bible verse and offer a prayer. And his sermon began with a verse from Matthew 9:36, from a time when Jesus was wandering, teaching, and healing. And the verse goes, "When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd." And hearing that, I thought of the Buddha wandering and teaching, and how still today, how many feel harassed and helpless in the face of the personal and collective disasters facing us in our world. And then Jesus says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." And so he says, "Get out there. Get out there and help people out a little." The minister then talked about the confusion and fear of our times, how so many are caught up in the thrall of social media, their attention and best intentions hijacked and consumed. Of course, the message was that the teachings of Jesus Christ are the salvation from fear and confusion. But it wasn't that hard to feel the spirit of the Bodhisattva path being expressed in the language of a different tradition. I was quite moved as we read a prayer of reconciliation together. It was very easy to layer in the language of the Dharma as we read. So I'm going to read it to you with just a few changes. I'm just going to substitute a very few words, like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, where gods and Christs are. Okay, here's what we read. "We feel called to follow the Bodhisattva path out into the world, but sometimes it's easier to stay where we feel comfortable. We have not always followed the way of the Buddha, but have instead taken detours that suit our own needs. We know there is work to do, but we put our own desires over our vow to work for the benefit of all beings. We don't always see Buddha nature within and around us because our own greed and selfishness blind us. Rather than go where our vows call us, we often stay put because that is safer. We must forgive ourselves and each other when the harvest goes unharvested, and we don't extend the grace of hospitality to those who are seeking refuge and true freedom." So that, with just a few tweaks, is the prayer that I prayed in my old church. And after church, Sophia introduced me to the pastor, saying Kate was something of a rebel back in the day. This 91-year-old woman remembered the letter I'd written to the local paper in response to their editorial lamenting high school students who refused to salute the flag. I did not correct her impression that I'd been some kind of rabble-rouser who chose to stand in homeroom and not salute the flag, because I did not believe that we were one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. My letter politely defended the right to dissent in a democracy, and resulted in an anonymous message delivered to the family mailbox saying, "Our country, love it or leave it." But really, I was just an anguished, lonely, conscience-racked teenager. I wasn't in any kind of movement at all. As we chatted, the pastor shared that he was reading a novel by Haruki Murakami, one of his favorite writers. And I came away feeling that I could actually have a substantial conversation with this guy. I think I might email him with my thanks and reflections and let him know that he was talking to a Zen priest. A week later, I went again to the church, to my brother and sister-in-law's Methodist church, and listened to the newly ordained lesbian woman pastor give her talk. This church went through the complex and challenging process of breaking with the mainstream organization over the issue of gay marriage and ordination for LGBTQ people. She gave a feminist interpretation of the Old Testament story of Sarah and Hagar, but that's another story we don't have time for today. And that same evening, I sat with the Red Rose Zen Sangha again in the Unitarian Church basement. And I gave a version of a talk I gave here earlier this year on kintsugi, the Japanese practice of mending a broken cup or bowl with gold lacquer, leaving glowing lines, creating a beauty in the brokenness. The metaphor felt somehow fitting, as this mysterious process of reconciliation with my own origins, familial, spiritual, political, is a kind of healing of the broken places in me, allowing some semblance of wholeness that includes the damage and the healing. So I wanted to share these stories with those of you who are home leavers of one sort or another, who may despair of such healing. May you live long enough. May your heart stay open enough to heal and reconnect beyond the breaks, beyond the distances, beyond the separation. Thank you, everyone, for your kind listening. Let's chant together. This is the smoke. May our intention equally extend
to every being
and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.